Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Friday, August 21st. I'm your reader, Bob Young. This morning, The Courier is predicting a partly sunny day with a high of 88 and a low of 64 tonight. Resident describes tanker crash. A massive diesel spill evacuated a Waterloo neighborhood for much of Thursday after a tanker truck crashed into a house. One resident was inside the Ridgeway Avenue home and escaped injury, but the driver remained trapped in the crumpled semi, which had rolled and cracked a pole holding up a high voltage line. I was in bed, and boom, I thought, what the heck, said Andy Olson, a retired Waterloo firefighter who has been living at the house for 32 years. He was asleep in a lower level bedroom in the corner of the home where the tanker crashed. This article opens with a photograph of an upside-down gasoline tanker and a big hole in the house that it ran into. I looked out what used to be my window, and all I could see was wreckage, Olson said. The truck blocked his front door, so he fled through the back door. The quick-trip tanker was holding more than 7,000 gallons of diesel fuel, which flowed down the street, prompting authorities to evacuate homes within a 1,000-foot radius. Waterloo Fire Rescue's hazardous materials team was called to contain the fuel spill, while other firefighters freed the driver with the help of an earth mover that shored up the debris. We diked off the majority of the storm sewers in the area, DNR was called. We used pretty much all of our specialized equipment, from airbags to some of our larger tools. We put down some foam for extreme caution, said Fire Chief Pat Treblor. The driver was taken to Mercy One Medical Center for treatment. Before striking the house, the semi apparently hit a minivan near the intersection of Ridgeway and Hammond Avenue, causing minor injuries to that driver, and then plowed into two parked SUVs in a neighboring driveway. Police said the crash started with a bizarre call about a disturbance near the Quick Trip fuel blending facility on West Ridgeway Avenue. The driver had apparently crashed a lone semi-cab through a chain-link fence at the compound and then became stuck in a group of trees. He then climbed into the tanker truck and sped off down Ridgeway Avenue, according to police. Officers began to search for the vehicle and spotted it near the intersection of Kimball and Ridgeway. As police turned to catch up and regain sight of the vehicle, it crashed into the house. Postal protest set in Waterloo. Equipment removal from Waterloo Post Office sparks Saturday protest, filed by Kristen Guess. And the story opens with a photograph of the United States Post Office in Waterloo. Demonstrators opposing sweeping changes to the United States Postal Service plan to gather outside the Waterloo Post Office on Saturday in support of the mail system that has been in place for more than 200 years. The protest comes as changes in overtime rules, delivery practices, and the removal of hundreds of mail sorting machines across the country have caused a public outcry over delivery delays and the potential to upset mail-in voting in the upcoming presidential election. There's going to be quite a few people participating in the demonstration, showing the country how important even a small post office is. I think it's very powerful, said Kimberly Carroll, president of the Postal Service Workers in Waterloo. Americans for Democratic Action, Iowa, Iowa Allegiance for Retired Americans, and Black Hawk County Supervisor Chris Swartz will host the rally at 11 a.m. Saturday outside the Waterloo Post Office at 300 Sycamore Street. Carroll, who has worked for the Postal Service for nearly 30 years, sounded the alarm this week about the removal of sorting equipment from Waterloo Post Office. She appeared on several national news networks as the first person to speak out about the drastic changes. Quote, there is a significant amount of mail that was being held back, she said. Louis DeJoy took over the role of Postmaster General on June 16th and implemented cost-saving measures to the organization that employs about 630,000 people. Carroll said the new rules, including eliminating or reducing overtime, removing mail sorting machines, and reducing the amount of trips a carrier can make to retrieve more mail, were announced immediately after DeJoy took office, and within days, the changes were in effect in Waterloo. Quote, it was amazing how quickly these changes were taking place and how dramatically it was going to have an impact on delivery for customers, Carroll said. Nicole Hill, a spokesperson for the Northland and Iowa Hawkeye District of the USPS, disputes that claim. Quote, the Postal Service in Waterloo is not experiencing any delays in processing or delivery at this time and has ample capacity to handle any volume today, during the election season, the holidays, and beyond, she said in a statement to the Courier Thursday afternoon. But Carol, a sales and service associate in Waterloo, said she has witnessed delays in deliveries, which many fear is an attempt to affect the absentee ballot mail-in process in November. On Tuesday, DeJoy, a major donor to President Trump's campaign, reversed course, delaying changes to the Postal Service until after the November election. Quote, I came to the Postal Service to make changes to secure the success of this organization and its long-term sustainability. I believe significant reforms are essential to that objective, and work toward those reforms will commence after the election, his statement reads. Whether the mail sorting machine removed in Waterloo will be reinstated remains unclear. The sorter, capable of handling 35,000 pieces of mail an hour, is one of six machines in Waterloo used to sort letter-sized mail and is part of the process carriers use to gather mail before hitting the streets, Carroll said. The other five remain in operation, as well as other types of sorting machines and equipment. In an interview with the Courier on Thursday, Senator Chuck Grassley said he was not aware of a machine being removed in Waterloo or of Carroll's appearance on national news, but he did say changes have been happening to make the postal system more efficient for several years. Quote, it's time to conform the Postal Service to the business of today compared to 20 years ago. There's a lot less business today, Grassley said. Grassley said since the 1970s, the USPS has been an independent agency and not politically affiliated. Quote, this postmaster has been on the job 2 months, so he's just carrying on what's being done under the previous postmaster. He's appointed by a board of governors, not the president. He's not involved in the political system at all, Grassley said. However, a report on NPR Thursday noted House Democrats are raising questions about whether a number of the board of governors skirted typical practices to influence DeJoy's hiring. Representatives Raja Krishnamurti, Democrat of Illinois, and Katie Porter, Democrat of California, sent a letter to USPS board member John Barger, raising questions about his role in recommending DeJoy for the position. The letter cites reports DeJoy was not included in a pool of candidates cultivated and vetted by an outside hiring firm contracted to fill the job. DeJoy is the first Postmaster General in almost two decades who is not a career postal employee. Quote, the United States Postal Service is one of our nation's most trusted institutions, said Blackhawk County Supervisor Chris Swartz. We rely on the Postal Service to deliver our medications, pay our bills, vote safely during a pandemic, and keep the economy running. Americans will not stand for the attempts to undermine this valuable service, unquote. Organizers of Saturday's rally are demanding the sorting machine be returned to the Waterloo Post Office, that Senators Joni Ernst and Grassley support Congress in providing emergency COVID-19 aid to the USPS, and DeJoy immediately reverse all recent changes to the USPS practices and procedures. Grassley said any disruptions in mail-in voting won't be because of the Postal Service. Quote, in some states, they can't get an absentee ballot until 2 weeks before election. It's not the Postal Service's fault. It's the fault of state laws, he said. President Trump has said he opposes additional funding for the post office, which has lost $2.2 billion in its most recently reported quarter. Congress allocated $10 billion in funding for the USPS under the CARES Act for losses related to the pandemic. Democrats are demanding a $25 billion grant through the HEROES Act, which includes $3.5 billion to expand voting by mail. Trump blames Democrats for delaying the aid. They need the money in order to have the post office work so it can take all of those millions and millions of ballots, Trump said in an interview on Fox Business. Quote, if they don't get those two items, that means you can't have universal mail-in voting because they're not equipped to have it, unquote. But Carroll said the postal system is equipped to handle election mail, and USPS workers are accustomed to adjustments during peak mail times. Quote, the election is not something new. We've been having election mail since the Civil War, she said. In a way, it's given higher priority the closer it gets to the election time, so we can make sure every vote counts, unquote. Carroll suggested voters mail in absentee ballots as soon as possible. Quote, we still have the capacity to keep up with demand as long as mail-in ballots come in early, she said. Our mail processing operators are working as hard as they can in the time we are allowed, unquote. Mail carriers typically return to the post office several times a day to retrieve more mail, Carroll said, but the new rules limit the number of trips mail carriers can make back to the office. Our operators get very frustrated because they've been in a culture where it's deliver every piece every day, she said. The changes made that more difficult, she said. Quote, we're going to put through as much mail as we can in a day, and what can't go will sit for the next day. The new mandates also affect overtime hours. Staffing shortages in mail offices across the country have led to overtime hours. Many retiring employees are not being replaced, she noted. Our workforce has shrunk significantly, she said. With the limitation on overtime, Carroll said available resources are going to waste. We're not utilizing all available manpower to get the mail out because that would require additional overtime, she said. The Waterloo Post Office processes mail for smaller post offices. After hurricane-force winds devastated buildings in the Cedar Rapids area last week, mail was temporarily redirected to Waterloo. And some say mail has slowed during the pandemic, Carroll said. She has seen a massive increase. Typically, Christmas is the Postal Service's busiest time of the year, she said. But the amount of mail being sent during the pandemic has surpassed that. Quote, people were responding to the need for PPE, sending all over the country, because that's just what people in America do. And the Postal Service facilitates that generosity, she said. The post office also became a tool for communicating with those who are unable to leave their homes. Quote, it's a safety net for our customers. We fill an important gap in our ability to share information and communicate with one another. Iowa Medical Director was aware for weeks of COVID data flaw filed by the Associated Press. The article opens with a photograph of Dr. Caitlin Pedotti speaking in front of an American flag. Iowa City. Iowa's medical director said Thursday she was aware of inaccuracies in the state's coronavirus data when her agency used it to release flawed calculations that helped guide decisions on school openings and enrollment this month. Dr. Caitlin Pedotti, the state epidemiologist, said she became aware in late July of a problem in Iowa's disease surveillance reporting system that backdated thousands of new test results. Nonetheless, Governor Kim Reynolds on August 6th released 14-day county positivity rates on the state's coronavirus website that she said would help school officials and parents decide how to proceed with the school year. The state announced Wednesday that, because of the backdating problem, those positivity rates had been erroneous for two critical weeks and made changes that revised them. For 79 counties, the changes reduced their positivity rates, some dramatically. For the other 20 counties, the rates increased on Wednesday by an average of less than 1%. Errors in the local rate caused the Fort Dodge District to announce a delay in the school's start date and then abruptly reverse that decision this week when they were corrected. Others tracking the data say they're baffled by the dramatic changes and have lost trust in the tracking system's accuracy. Reynolds has said that schools with a 15% positivity rate a threshold 3 times higher than recommended by many public health experts, can apply for a waiver to start the year online. Otherwise, districts must offer at least 50% in-person instruction. Parents are also using the rates to determine whether to enroll their children in online-only options that districts are providing. Padotti said for anyone who was tested multiple times, their newest test result was recorded on the state's website as having occurred on the date of their first test. That means many new results were backdated to March, April, May, and June. The problem was widespread, as more than 100,000 people have been tested multiple times in Iowa since the start of the pandemic, Padotti said. Padotti did not explain why she knowingly allowed erroneous positivity rates to be released, but she framed this week's correction as a routine change to give the public better information. Quote, "We have to be flexible, and we want to incorporate new information and adjustments as we move along," she said. "I know that it's not ideal when things continue to change," unquote. At a news conference, the governor said the changes to the rates were minimal and did not affect the total number of people who have been tested positive, case investigations, or contact tracing. She blamed an antiquated state information technology system for the issue and said it underscored the need to spend money on upgrades. Reynolds acknowledged that the virus was spreading across the state, with deaths surpassing 1,000 this week, current hospitalizations increasing, and nursing home outbreaks on the rise. Reynolds said she learned about the data problem last week, but her administration did not acknowledge it until Wednesday, 2 days after the Associated Press reported on the backdated positive cases. That problem came to light only because an Iowa City nurse practitioner tracking the data on her own found discrepancies, got an Iowa Department of Public Health epidemiologist to acknowledge the system error in an email, and shared the correspondence with news outlets. Others who had been asking about apparent backdating, including Kara Conrad Baranowski of the Times-Citizen's newspaper in Iowa Falls, say they were either ignored or told only by public health spokeswoman Amy McCoy that the website was constantly updating with new information. Nonetheless, Reynolds claimed that her administration had been transparent with the pandemic data. Only one county is currently above 15% threshold, and Reynolds said that by next week, most school districts will have returned for classroom instruction. The state announced Thursday it was delivering 650,000 face masks, 110,000 face shields, and other personal protective equipment to school districts around the state for educators and students. Second person arrested in fatal robbery in Waterloo, filed by Jeff Reinitz. Waterloo. Another person has been arrested on robbery charges after a fatal shooting over the weekend. Officials said the investigation into the slaying of Vincent J. Hemingway on Adrian Street on Saturday dovetailed with a probe into an earlier shooting on West 6th Street. Waterloo police arrested Raphael Rashi Williams, 29, on Wednesday for first-degree robbery. He is also jailed on unrelated warrants. Bond is currently set at $111,000. Authorities allege Raphael Williams and others approached Hemingway in a garage at 556 Adrian Street around 11:40 p.m. As part of a robbery plan. During the encounter, Hemingway resisted when someone tried to take his lighter, and one of the other robbers opened fire, striking Hemingway. He later died at a hospital. Raphael Williams was found in the area following the shooting. Investigators found cell phone evidence that the Adrian Street robbery was supposed to be part of a string of robberies that were planned. On Tuesday, police arrested Anna H. Barambost McLaremore, 24, on robbery charges in the Adrian Street crime. While investigating the shooting, police developed information that led to Robert Lee Williams, Jr., 31, being charged with shooting Tony Campbell in the face on July 31st in an alley behind West 6th Street. Turning to the Cedar Valley section, changing station rule okayed. City Council passes changing station ordinance, filed by Jeff Rienitz. Waterloo. New businesses in Waterloo will have to install diaper changing stations under an ordinance passed by the City Council. Members voted 6-1, with Margaret Klein casting the dissenting vote, to include the requirements for new construction and bathroom renovations during Tuesday's meeting. Resident John Childs spoke out against the proposal, saying he opposed the measure after talking with business owners. Quote, "This particular ordinance only adds another thing that a potential business has to do. This has no benefit in public safety. It reaches into the business's pocket and says you must do this," Childs said. He proposed offering an incentive program to reward businesses that add changing stations instead of legislating the matter. Council member Jonathan Greider said the ordinance will allow people to take care of their children in a place away from people eating food when they begin returning to restaurants when the coronavirus pandemic subsides. Quote, "I see this as a bonus for the city of Waterloo because there will be a post-COVID Waterloo. We are going to be offering enticements after people are so used to going out and having food delivered," he said. Quote, "This ordinance is a step toward telling families that we welcome you as part of the community, and we are doing a small gesture to help make it easier for families to take part in the greater commerce that is Waterloo," Greider said. The ordinance would only apply to new Group A and Group M buildings, stores and assembly buildings like churches, theaters, arenas, and restaurants, as well as hospitals and city-owned buildings. It would also apply to existing buildings that undergo a substantial renovation to the restrooms. Greider also said there will also be an appeal process. Iowa jobless claims below 84,000, filed by Rob Bossart of the Courier Des Moines Bureau. Des Moines. Initial claims for unemployment benefits in Iowa rose slightly last week, but overall the number of Iowans requesting jobless assistance remained below 84,000. Iowa Workforce Development officials Thursday reported initial claims filed between Sunday, August 9th and Saturday, August 15th totaled 6,544. That includes 5,828 filed by individuals who work and live in Iowa, and 716 claims sought by non-residents. The number of continuing weekly unemployment claims was 83,610, a decrease of 8,490 from the previous week. Initial claims reported on August 13th were 5,282, and continuing claims at 92,853. The United States Department of Labor adjusted last week's initial claim number in Iowa down to 4,891, a decrease of 391, and lowered the total of continuing claims to 92,100, a decrease of 753, for a total decline of 1,144, according to Iowa Workforce Development. Officials with the state agency said they rely on weekly data released by the U.S. Labor Department to report their numbers, and they also adopt the federal revisions to the previously published data. Unemployment insurance benefits payments to jobless Iowans, $23,465,906 last week. Industries with the most claims were manufacturing, with 1,664. Followed by a grouping of self-employed, independent contractors, and others at 887. After that, healthcare and social assistance industries totaled 608, construction 449, and accommodation and food service establishments with 429 initial claims last week. A total of $7,881,600 in federal pandemic unemployment compensation benefits was paid during the week of August 9 through 15, which were retroactive payments as the program ended July 25th. Since April 4th, a total of $1,580,831,143 in FPUC benefits has been paid, according to Iowa workforce development officials. Also, a total of $4,412,626 was paid in pandemic unemployment assistance benefits during the past week, and $3,912,116 in separate pandemic emergency unemployment compensation were paid. Iowans whose unemployment is the result of the pandemic and who are eligible for at least $100 in benefits each week will qualify for an additional $300 in weekly benefits retroactive to the week ending August 1st. State officials say the federal agencies continue to issue guidance, and Iowa Workforce Development will continue developing the implementation process required for this program and update its website as additional information becomes available. Since the announcement of the program approval, Iowa Workforce Development has seen an increase in the initial and continuing claims as awareness of the benefits become more widely known. Officials anticipate this will be reflected in increased claim numbers next week. Individuals who have exhausted the additional 13 weeks of PEUC benefits may be eligible for state extended benefits announced in June. Claimants should continue to file weekly claims so that their claims can be reviewed to determine eligibility for state benefits. Those benefits may provide eligible claimants up to an additional 13 weeks of unemployment benefits, officials said. However, not everyone who qualified for PEUC will be eligible for the state extended benefits. Iowa Workforce Development previously had waived the work search requirement since the beginning of the pandemic, but this requirement will be reinstituted on September 8, according to the agency. Total jobless numbers do not reflect those who have stopped looking for work or who have some reason to have cycled out of the system. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier for Friday, August 21st on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Bradley J. Marin, 40, of Waterloo, died Wednesday, August 5, in Olwine. He was born April 18, 1980, in St. Paul, Minnesota, son of David and Laura Stransky Marin Little. He married Mitzi Bjork August 7, 2004, at Trinity Lutheran in Waterloo. Bradley graduated from East High School and went to Hawkeye Tech for auto mechanics. He was employed as a utility locator with USIC for 10 years and was currently employed by Lodge Construction. Services will be Monday, August 24th at 11 a.m. at Haggerty Wycroft Growip Funeral Service on South Street. Visitation will be Sunday from 2 to 5 p.m. at the funeral home and will continue for an hour before services on Monday. Due to COVID-19, everyone is required to wear a mask at either the visitation or the service. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be left at www.haggertywycroftgrowerup.com. Brad was a devoted husband and dad. He would spend hours playing games or trying to figure out riddles. He liked to tease and tell jokes, making those around him smile and laugh. He enjoyed camping, baseball, and cooking. He will be dearly missed. Charles Thomas T.J. Johnson passed away August 15, 2020. He was born on December 6, 1957, in Cedar Falls, to Richard and Catherine Johnson. He graduated NUHS in 1976 and married Melinda C. Perry in 1978. They had three sons, Chris of Cedar Falls, Jeremy of Rhinebeck, Iowa, Tim of Cedar Falls. He was a devoted husband, father, and brother, and friend will be greatly missed by many. There will be a celebration of life Sunday, August 23rd, at FOE Eagles Club, 2125 West Lone Tree Road, Cedar Falls, Iowa, 50613. All proceeds may be directed to Melinda Johnson. Waterloo, Russell G. Blay, 87, of Waterloo, Washburn, died Wednesday, August 19th, at LaPorte City Specialty Care. He was born September 22, 1932, in Waterloo, the son of Burdette and Mabel West Blay. He married Georgia Ann Caldwell, January 17, 1953, at St. Mary's Church in Waterloo. Russell graduated from Upper Iowa University before being employed by Viking Pump as a machinist. He retired in 1997. A private family memorial service will be held at a later date. Memorials may be directed to the family. Condolences may be left at www.HaggertyWyckoffGrawrup.com. Virginia M. Ruger, Cedar Falls. Virginia Mabel Ruger, 92, of Cedar Falls, formerly of Waterloo, died Thursday, August 20, 2020, at Deary Suites of the Western Home Communities of Natural Causes. Services will be held 10:30 a.m. Monday, August 24, 2020, at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Evansdale, with burial in the Garden of Memories Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday at Kern's Funeral Service, Kimball Chapel, and also 1 hour before the service at the church. Memorials may be directed to Unity Point Hospice. Kern's Funeral Home Service, Kimball Chapel, in charge of arrangements at this phone number, area code 319-233-3146. For more information, visit www.kernsfuneralservice.com. Paul W. Bremer, Tripola. Paul Vern Bremer, 84, of Tripola, died Wednesday evening, August 19, 2020, at the Cedar Valley Hospice Home in Waterloo. Private family's funeral services will be held at Grace Lutheran Church in Tripola, with Reverend Dennis Nyswack officiating. All family attending the funeral are required to mask, and we will observe social distancing. The funeral service will be live-streamed on Becker Milnes and Reddick's Facebook page on Monday, August 24th at 10:30 a.m. Interment will follow at Grace Lutheran Church Cemetery, rural Tripola, with military rites provided by Brandenburg Kruger Post number 4013, VFW of Tripola. Public visitation will be held from 4 o'clock p.m. to 7 o'clock p.m. Sunday, August 23rd, at Reddick Funeral Home in Tripola. Online condolences may be left at www.BeckerMilnesReddick.com. Doris M. Allen, 97, passed away peacefully in Gladbrook on August 14, 2020. Funeral services will be held 1:30 p.m. Friday, August 21, 2020, at the Anderson Funeral Home in Marshalltown. Visitation will be 12:30 p.m. until the time of the services at the funeral home. Interment will be at Maple Hill Cemetery in rural Gladbrook. Online condolences may be sent to www.andersonfhs.com. Doris was born September 4, 1922, to William and Martha Moore. Doris made her mark on the world with her keen business sense, strong friendships, and love of family. Doris was raised in Gladbrook, enjoyed working in the office of her father's garage, and graduated with the class of 1939. She then attended Gates Business College in Waterloo, graduating in 1941. She began her career in the administrative office at Rath Packing Company until she married Ralph Severs in 1942. They became parents to two children, Ronald and Patricia. The Severs family made their home in Waterloo until 1947, when they began farming in Grant Township. Ralph died in a farm accident during the blizzard of April 1973. Doris later worked at the Dom's State Farm Insurance Agency in Traer until 1978, when she married George Allen. They made their home in Mount Home, Mountain Home, Arkansas, and McAllen, Texas, until his death in 1997. Doris permanently relocated to her hometown of Gladbrook in 2003, where she enjoyed many corn carnivals, family gatherings, and living among lifelong friends. The family requests memorials be directed to Peace UCC in Gladbrook or the Gladbrook Fire and Ambulance Service. Turning to sports now, parents not happy with Big Ten response, filed by Steve Batterson. The story opens with a photograph of Phil Spiewak, father of Iowa football player Austin Spiewak, and he's holding a letter that players of Hawkeye football presented to the Big Ten earlier this month, and he's standing in front of a building with a big sign that says Big Ten. Labeling Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren's response to their concerns, quote, unacceptable, parents of Iowa football players plan to go to conference headquarters on Friday in search of answers. In a letter issued Thursday, the Hawkeye parents reiterated that players deserve to know what led to the Big Ten to scrap plans for a fall football schedule last week, 6 days after unveiling a revised schedule and medical protocols designed to move things forward despite concerns surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic. The group has said it wants football season to be played this fall, a decision Warren indicated in a letter written Wednesday would not be revisited by league presidents and chancellors. Commissioner Warren and the president have once again failed to address our questions and concerns, and therefore their response is unacceptable, the Iowa parents wrote. Quote, the lack of transparency, hypocrisy, and failure of leadership gives us no confidence in this decision and future decisions. Warren offered a list of reasons why presidents and chancellors believed uncertainties surrounding the coronavirus made it unsafe to proceed with fall sports in the conference, but did not provide the data justifying that decision that the parents are seeking. The handling of the situation has been criticized by several Big Ten athletics administrators and coaches. Players who believed a season would happen when the schedule and medical protocols were released have expressed displeasure as well. An online petition put together this week by Ohio State quarterback Justin Fields asking the conference to reverse its decision attracted more than 250,000 signatures in the first 24 hours it was posted. The Iowa Parents Group said players need better answers about why the conference chose to reverse course, postponing a season it is now contemplating starting in early January. Big Ten players who have sacrificed so much deserve better. Big Ten parents and fans deserve better, the group's letter continued. The athletes who suffered due to the economic impact of this decision and the loss of opportunity to realize their dreams are in our thoughts and prayers. They are not blind to the risk of playing and never have been. Collectively, we demand better of the Big Ten. The Iowa parents have had nearly 200 people participate in online meetings since a group of 13 began a grassroots effort to have the season reinstated last week. In the days since, parents of players from Michigan, Nebraska, Ohio State, and Penn State have followed their lead, sending letters to Warren questioning the action taken last week and the reasons behind why the action was taken. Iowa parents previously announced they plan to join parents from several other Big Ten schools in traveling to the league office in Rosemont, Illinois, on Friday, with a goal of meeting with Warren. On Thursday, Iowa parents indicated they still plan to make the trip and encouraged parents of players from other conferences' schools to join them there. Collectively, we deserve better from the Big Ten, they wrote. Waterloo Bucks clinch Minnesota-Iowa Pod Championship, filed by Nick Petteros. And it opens with a photograph with a caption, Waterloo Bucks Zach Button is congratulated by Brett McCleary after scoring a run against Mankato Thursday at Riverfront Stadium. Waterloo Bucks second-year manager Casey Harms hopped into his vehicle for a lengthy late-June drive from California to Waterloo in the middle of a COVID-19 pandemic, unsure what to expect. The Northwoods League had shortened its slate from 72 games in 76 days to 41 games in 52 days with no playoffs. Some new talent joined the Wood Bat League, and others returned after they were passed over in the shortened MLB draft or received extra seasons of collegiate eligibility. Waterloo consistently won. The Bucks clinched the five-team Minnesota-Iowa Pod Championship on the final day of the regular season with convincing 17-6 win over Mankato. It took a 9-3 assist from Wilmar from Waterloo, 18-13, to edge St. Cloud, 27-13, team that made late change for the title by half game in the standings. Quote, "We've been really lucky to just be out there in the first place, but also being able to win some games and give the fans a quality product," Harm said. "We've had a slew of guys here. Just giving these guys an opportunity to play and complete with and win games and also have fun with this environment and this crowd, getting to experience the Cedar Valley, because I think it's a special place." Many of Waterloo's summer mainstays, like Patrick Ferguson, the longest tenured player in franchise history, and talented catcher Alonzo Rebelcaba, had returned to their college communities well before Thursday's finale. Waterloo's bottom three slots in Thursday's finale lineup were occupied by pitchers still in town. Yet, it was the team's most experienced remaining player who set the tone for this victory. Leadoff hitter and second baseman Jaylen Smith, playing in his 38th game out of 41, reached base all six trips to the plate, recorded four hits, stole three bases, and scored four runs. Peyton Williams, the fan-appointed Waterloo Bucks Player of the Year, finished with three singles, two RBIs, and two runs scored. Williams launched 13 home runs in 32 games to tie franchise's single-season record. Quote, "It put a little pressure on my shoulders to keep it going when everybody left," Smith said. Quote, "Peyton did a good job, and that too, and so did Charlie Hess, stepping up. I was just glad we got to keep winning this whole time." Quote, "It gets you pumped up. That's what you play for, is a championship." Smith, a California Bakersfield product, entered Wednesday's finale with a .371 batting average and has been a consistent presence on the base paths in addition to one of Waterloo's most reliable fielders. Quote, "It helped me a lot seeing really good pitching, especially at the beginning of the year," Smith said. "I've honestly never seen 95 mile per hour consistently every day, so that's a good experience for me. Seeing really good pitchers all the time is going to make you better. It was a good experience all the way around. I haven't been outside of California that much, especially for a long period of time. It was fun meeting a bunch of people from different places, all different personalities." Williams, a powerful University of Iowa freshman, also came into his own through this summer's experience with the Bucks. Quote, "It was good to be able to see what it's like to play every day and know what it feels like," Williams said. Members of the Bucks team gathered together for photos and watched the end of the Wilmar-St. Cloud game on the stadium scoreboard. No matter how many games they played in Waterloo this summer, all were part of something special. Quote, "You almost feel like you're best friends with them before you leave," Williams said of his teammates. Waterloo's pitching staff of Duncan Devitt, Jack Radford, and Will Christofferson surrendered five runs on three homers, but otherwise limited damage. Devitt picked up his third win after holding Mankato to two runs over five innings. The Bucks' offense ended up with 20 hits. In total, 13,659 fans entered Riverfront Stadium this abbreviated season, including 1,037 on this final night. Resilient and welcoming are the two words Harms used to describe this championship team. Quote, "We welcomed some faces the last couple of weeks, and we had to catch them up to speed," Harms said. Then they were resilient dealing with the new protocols of COVID, the masks, temperature checks. Us making it this far was their responsibility and trying to stay safe and healthy as possible. Quote, you had to ask a bunch of college kids to act like adults, and the fact that we're still here is a testament to their maturity. Chiefs to prohibit Native American imagery at Arrowhead, filed by the Associated Press. And it opens up with a photograph of a couple dressed in red and wearing feathered headdresses. Kansas City, Missouri. The Kansas City Chiefs will prohibit the wearing of Native American headdresses, face paint, and clothing at Arrowhead Stadium. They also are discussing the future of the iconic tomahawk chop as they address what many consider racist imagery associated with their franchise. The team said in a statement Thursday that the changes came after conversations with national organizations that work closely on issues that affect Native Americans. They also come on the heels of the NFL team in Washington, choosing to drop Redskins as its nickname after a long and often contentious dialogue with fans and the public. In 2014, we began a dialogue with a group of local leaders from diverse American Indian backgrounds and experiences, the team said in a statement. Quote, as an organization, our goal was a better understanding of issues facing American Indian communities in our region and explore opportunities to raise awareness of American Indian cultures and celebrate the rich tradition of tribes with a historic connection to the Kansas City area, unquote. In response to that initial collaboration with the Chiefs, began celebrating American Indian Heritage Month by inviting elders to a game each year and having them do a ceremonial blessing of the drum and the four directions of Arrowhead Stadium. Those discussions also led to the Chiefs discouraging the wearing of ceremonial headdresses and face paint, though they were still seen throughout Arrowhead Stadium on game days. Now, those fans wearing often elaborate headdresses and face paint will be stopped at the gate and prohibited from entering the facility. The Chiefs also said they are engaging in a thorough review process of the Arrowhead Chop, which is also used by fans of the Florida State Seminoles, Atlanta Braves, and other sports teams. The team also hopes to shift the focus of the war drum that is pounded at the start of games to, quote, something that symbolizes the heartbeat of the stadium, unquote. We are exploring all options for a modified engagement moment from the drum deck that maintains a unifying effect between our fans and our players, but better represents the spiritual significance of the drum, the team said. The Chiefs, who are named after former Mayor Harold Rowe Chief Bartle, have made other changes throughout the years to distance themselves from Native American imagery. The pinto horse named War Paint that rides onto the field was originally ridden by a man in full Native American headdress, but for years it's been ridden by a cheerleader instead. Despite the changes, there have continued to be occasional demonstrations, protests, and public outcry at Chiefs games at home and on the road. Native Americans sought to have the Arizona Cardinals bar face paint when the Chiefs visited several years ago, and protests took place in Minnesota in 2015 before a game against the Vikings. Officials and students at nearby Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, Kansas, asked the Chiefs to ban behavior that invokes stereotypes amid their 2016 playoff run. And when the franchise won its first Super Bowl in 50 years in February, it once again put the subject of tradition versus racism at the forefront of the national consciousness. The team did not address its nickname, its logo of KC, inside an Arrowhead, or the name of Arrowhead Stadium itself in a statement Thursday, but it did say that it was exploring the creation of a formalized education program, and it promised to continue discussions with Native American groups moving forward. Quote, we are grateful for the meaningful conversations we have had with all of these American Indian leaders, the team said. quote, "It is important we continue the dialogue on these significant topics and we move forward to continuing to work together." Jessup man surprised by big lottery win. Jessup, a Jessup man who won a $50,000 lottery prize, said he didn't realize right away that he'd won big. Gilbert Marsh, 79, won the 16th top prize in the Iowa Lottery's $50,000 Super Crossword Scratch Game. He purchased his winning ticket at Music Station in Independence. Marsh scratched the ticket when he got home and began tallying the completed words on his ticket. "I just scratched it and then I started counting," he recalled Tuesday as he claimed his prize at the Iowa Lottery headquarters in Clive. "I got up to 8. Then I counted again. I got up to 9. And then I threw it at her. She counted and it was 10. His wife Cheryl thought he'd won a top prize, but urged him to get further verification. "I had him go over to our son's house and have him verify it," she said. "I just couldn't believe it." Marsh and his wife plan to use the winnings to pay bills, buy a new roof for their home, and repair their truck. Man detained following stabbing standoff. Filed by Jeff Reinitz. LaPorte City. One person was taken to a hospital for an evaluation and another for stab wounds following a standoff in LaPorte City early Thursday. Authorities received a call at 501 Walnut Street shortly after 5 a.m. Blackhawk County Sheriff's deputies said a woman inside the home had apparently been stabbed by her adult son, who refused to come out of the house. The sheriff's office tactical unit responded, and negotiators were able to talk the son into surrendering without further incident. The woman was taken to the hospital for treatment, and she is expected to survive, according to deputies. The incident remains under investigation, and charges are pending, according to deputies. Bannon pleads not guilty. Ex-Trump aide, others accused of bilking donors over wall. Filed by the Associated Press. New York. President Donald Trump's former chief strategist, Steve Bannon, was pulled from a luxury yacht and arrested Thursday on allegations that he and three associates ripped off donors trying to fund a southern border wall, making him the latest in a long list of Trump allies to be charged with a crime. The organizers of the We Build the Wall group portrayed themselves as eager to help the president build a big, beautiful barrier along the U.S.-Mexico border, as he promised during the 2016 campaign. They raised more than $25 million from thousands of donors and pledged that 100% of the money would be used for the project. But according to the criminal charges unsealed Thursday, much of the money never made it to the wall. Instead, it was used to line the pockets of group members, including Bannon, who served in Trump's White House and worked for his campaign, the charges read. He allegedly took over $1 million, using some to secretly pay co-defendant Brian Kolfage, the founder of the project, and to cover hundreds of thousands of dollars in personal expenses. Charges included conspiracy to commit wire fraud and conspiracy to commit money laundering. At his hearing, Bannon appeared by video with his hands cuffed in front of him and a white mask covering most of his face. The magistrate judge approved Bannon's release on $5 million bail, cured by $1.75 million in assets.
And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, August 21st. He's been your reader, Bob. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Whales and dolphins are spectacular creatures. Their ancestors climbed out of the ocean 360 million years ago, developed lungs and legs, and evolved into mammals. Then, 50 million years ago, they walked back into the sea. To survive there, they developed specialized behaviors, which require even more special biology. Perhaps most famous is echolocation. They move air between sinus cavities to emit sound. When it bounces back to them, they don't hear it with their ears, but feel it in a fatty fluid in their lower jaw. Only toothed whales, like sperm whales, orcas, and dolphins, can echolocate, which we think they developed to hunt prey, especially squid, in the darkness of the deep ocean. Baleen whales focused on other prey, floating shrimp-like creatures, and for this they develop comb-like plates in place of teeth. They can't echolocate, but are known for their elaborate songs. We think they use these for communication, but we're not sure how they produce them, since they don't have vocal cords. Both types of whales can hold their breath for 45 minutes or longer. To do this, they reduce their heart rate and cut blood flow to some organs, like the stomach, while providing it to others, like the brain. Even their blood is specialized. It can carry far more oxygen than land-dwelling mammals, and they have much more of it. Whales are an amazing example of what evolution can do, given enough time. I'm Scott Tinker, spouting off on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.